where we came from, where we've been. They're eternal questions that say a lot about where we're going as the human race. Welcome to Ancient Mysteries on the Air. Welcome to Ancient Mysteries on the Air. I'm Jim Harold. So glad to be with you once again. And we have a fascinating topic for you today. There is a recent new book out. In fact, it's called Sacred Geometry in Ancient Goddess Cultures, The Divine Science of the Female Priesthood. And our guest today is the author of that book, Richard Heath. He is a system designer who studies the technical achievements of the ancient world, from those of the megalithic astronomers to sacred building design. He's the author of several books, including Sacred Number and the Origins of Civilization and Sacred Geometry, Language of the Angels. He lives near Cardigan in Wales, and we're so glad to have him with us. Richard Heath, welcome to the program today.
Thank you, Jim.
This may go without saying, but how much do average folks not understand the importance of the femininity in spiritual traditions? Because we've all been brought up, most of us, in very kind of patriarchal systems. How much do we miss that the feminine used to be a very, very important part of spirituality?
I think it's because most of Europe certainly was not Neolithic. It didn't farm. And so in my thesis is that women formed the core, the natural core of hunter-gatherer groups. And around that, a kind of mystique grows up because you inherit the name of your mother rather than your father. And the role of men and the role of women was different because you went out to hunt. So when confronting these megaliths that cropped up in all around the world, really, but in a very interesting way in Europe and in the Mediterranean, we find evidence of women actually having a leadership role. And then shortly after that, the Neolithic, which is basically patriarchal farmers, they handle it in terms of the myths that were written about it to show it as rather quirky or maybe threatening. So it was a cultural takeover, I think. But the problem with it today is that much, I believe, of our knowledge of numbers and geometry and how we measure things and also our astronomical symbolism must have come from the megalithic work of astronomy. But modern science doesn't want to really accept that. And yet, we don't otherwise know where it all came from. So the female story is very important for understanding where we are today, because in some respects, we are in danger of, let's say, changing the orbit of the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the orbit of the moon is synchronized in various ways, which I consider probably have some spiritual function. And so there is a need to rediscover what was known in the ancient astronomy, which led to our spiritual stories about gods, often planets, or parts of the sky, and not really worry too much about being a gender in one way or another. But the idea is that this is all human knowledge, and currently we've suppressed the oldest human knowledge.
Now, how widespread is this influence and in various structures that women were involved in and took these leadership roles? I mean, I want to make sure that people are clear. We're not talking about one or two sites. We're talking about pretty much all over the world, right?
Yep. But the best documented situations, there are some quite well documented in South America, I think, but in Crete, in the Mediterranean, we have two very significant sites, two islands. One is called Malta, and that had a sort of golden age, and after that came, from about 2000 BC onwards, a very beautiful culture called the Minoans, after they were rediscovered by archaeology. It turns out that they had palaces all over the island, massive trading fleets, and influence all over the Mediterranean. And you see pictures on friezes of meetings in their temple courtyards where all of the ladies look the same, and they're very, very pretty women with ringlets. And so that must have been a very odd culture for us today. But they had a lot of knowledge going on to do with the moon and the sun and the nodes. And generally, they're the best documented example, partly through myths, but partly because the stuff on the ground hasn't been too badly disturbed. So this is, and then you get experts that have looked deeper in time and have seen all the art. And this art is very geometrical often and mm-hmm. very varied, with the woman at the center. And of course, the womb, the importance of the womb, because everybody in these tribes came from the womb. Obviously, they still do. But mm-hmm. the interesting thing is that it must have been a metaphor for the creativity of the world that women could create new life.
Now, when you talk about leadership positions, are we talking yeah. about just spiritual positions? Or are we talking about, and I know, and I just had this discussion with someone else, there used to be, you know, these days we have a very kind of big separation between spirituality and other aspects of life, where is in the past that wasn't so much the case. But I guess my question is, if I could spit it out here, is what kind of leadership positions are we talking about women having?
On Crete, one sees what's called the triple goddess, that women go through a young period, a middling period, and an older period. And these were associated quite clearly with the planet Venus, that is, has bright manifestations first in the evening, and then it zooms past the sun under the ground, and then it has on the evening. And then you get the Earth, who is the fundamental goddess, because life comes out of the goddess. And then you get the third goddess, which is the wizened moon, who appears, you know, appears not particularly full of life. Whether they could perceive it as a sphere, I don't know. So the triple goddess was a widespread concept in that world, and so women had those roles, and that they appeared to be on thrones, and very beautiful. So they would often be called Queen Bee, for instance, in villages in the mainland of Greece, all property was more or less communal, but it would be distributed by lot. And so you get some good land, some bad land, some middling land, and things like this. So in some ways, it could have been a very nice culture to live in, because a lot of what we see in history is the history of farming producing towns and cities, particularly first in the Middle East. And in those situations, you naturally get kings. And so we had city kings and city gods and so on. So But I believe that the ancient Middle East was relatively young, even though it's 3,000 to 2,000, very approximately, BC. The main ideas were inherited, I believe, from deeper sources. And we see those slightly in Göbekli Tepe. Are we sure that they were male or female? And there we have lovely rings, which are surrounded by farming experiments, and all of their flora and fauna was perfect for creating the Neolithic Revolution. And so it's thought that 10,000 BC, probably, these people arose from somewhere north, and they were starting the Neolithic Revolution. And that revolution took the Indo-European language with it right through Europe. And so there are many dialects or Indo-European languages in Europe because of the spread of the Neolithic Revolution. And so what we're looking at with the women is the pre-existing order in Europe, and it's and their interest in astronomy, and the ability for a whole tribe to gather food without growing it, and to do building works and do astronomy, which, you know, nobody apart from a rich king could possibly think of doing. So it reverses our idea that places like Stonehenge were probably Neolithic. They can't be. They must be Mesolithic, which means late Mesolithic, middle, late Middle Stone Age type of life. I've talked for a long time, but
well, that's okay. We're enjoying getting your wisdom. Now, you talk about matriarchal astronomy. Why did that happen?
I think everybody will see when they start to categorize what they see in the phenomenon, they will see things that resonate with them. So, you know, we would tend to see the gods as angry kings or other things like that. But it may well be that a figure like Saturn, for instance, which is the second furthest planet from Jupiter there, and was clearly visible, that could have belonged to the matriarchal world in a very definite way, because they seem to have their calendars more set to the synodic period of Saturn, which is 378 days. And that's what when things coincide, looked at from the Earth. But they also, they had a period of 364 days, one day short, and the king was supposed to live for a year and a day. And in the book, you'll see, strangely, that the oldest monuments in the capital palace of Knossos in Crete appears to have these two time periods in it, with two twin pillars facing each other, which are just like you find in Göbekli Tepe. Mm-hmm. And then over at Malia, which is a holiday place to the west, no, to the east, sorry. There is a little round object with holes in it, which are 33 holes and then a 34th. And the exact distance between those two places, measured in miles, is the number of years it takes for the nodes of the moon, which cause eclipses, to rotate once around the Earth. And so it appears that the level of monuments and significance that they were engaged in, they were making these monuments and coding them up to be cosmic pictures. These days you call it a cosmogram. And this cosmograms, you'll see them going on right through patriarchal history, you know, with the Romans, the Greeks before them, and into our own history of the medieval. And at Angkor Wat, which is in Cambodia, one sees the same types of units of measure and things there, which, so this is a preceding culture that previously has been called Atlantean. But I think the solution to this is that there may be an Atlantis, but that the people who had this technology of measuring things had it in order to be able to count the astronomy as a number of days, a number of weeks. Now, and then if you do that, you find that the whole of the sky becomes meaningfully related to each part of itself. And so it's part of a single organized system of time on Earth, some of it coming through the moon, and some of it, like Venus, coming through the Earth. And it's based on musical harmonies, the golden mean, and various cosmic constants like that. And so what we're talking about is some big idea which our own scientists cannot see, because they never look at the world in such a simple way as to simply count all these periods. And so my wish is to somehow get a proper recognition of this work that was done in the past, rather than have it ignored. Because, for instance, if you make a mess of the moon, then we might be destroying something that's necessary about the harmony of the solar system.
Now, that kind of brings about a point there. You know, I think a lot of times, some people at least, when they look at these ancient mysteries and explore them, they have a tendency, and I think it's obviously short-sighted, but they have a tendency to say, well, what does that have to do with my life today? Can you speak to that more? Because I think that's important, why it is smart to study these ancient cultures and what really happened to understand today. But I'll let you give your thoughts on that.
In my own experience, we are now got to, if you look at a modern example of a physicist called David Bohm, there are ideas emerging that the quantum mechanical level of the universe, which we don't see, tells a story about how things are unfolded to become what we see, and enfolded to go back into the pattern that it comes from. And although this sounds a bit ludicrous, in fact, the looking at the whole of something appears to show us what we are, almost as if we're receiving a message. And the message, as I see it, is the humanity is supposed to be evolving to understand rather than to know things all the time. Because with knowledge, there is this desire to control things. But with the understanding, there is a connectivity with the universe as if we were supposed to understand it.
Interesting.
And I think a lot of our unhappiness today is that we are in a fragmented condition because we, for instance, we live totally almost in man-made environments. We, in some way, need to find a mode where, although science can be used to improve the lot of people, it evidently is being used to do all sorts of infinite tasks, like go to Mars or use AI, or and if we were to discover our own intelligence, I think it would rub off from knowing how the world was really. It would rub off on us that we would start to become less manipulative of the world, and more appreciative of it and caring of it.
Interesting, very interesting indeed. I believe when someone does a project like this, even if they're extremely knowledgeable, as of course you are, about these subjects, that they discover something. Maybe there's a surprise. Maybe there's even an epiphany. Was there anything like that for you in this project?
Well, it's a series of epiphanies. Like when you... I did a project with an American musicologist, and one of my books is about something that came out of that interaction with him. And I never understood music, really, but I was very, very, of course, in love with music. I think it's made an enormous difference to my life, but I'm not a technical or a musician. But to understand music takes you right back to the roots of number, as seemed to be the case with Pythagoras in Greece, that he went around the ancient mysteries. And when you understand something that seems complicated, and suddenly it resolves itself, and that's all it is, you know, that could be an epiphany of sorts. And so there are quite a few along the way, but I guess I've become more religious, but in a different type of way, because of seeing that the only possibility for all these things to be true that I have found would be that there was some mechanical law where all of the planets and everything else relaxed into the easiest sort of like solution without any mathematics or whatever. But I really think it's more like that that when it says in the Bible, for instance, that we are the image and likeness of God, this idea of God is if it's reflected in us, then the study of it allows us to become better attuned towards what that principle is. And so that's how I, that's why I see everybody could benefit from seeing the world as being a whole phenomenon that we are supposed to be able to read like a book. And our evolution won't occur if we simply go on with our approach towards living as it is. And a lot of our lives are being dominated by other people and other influences. So I don't know how any improvement could be had along these lines, apart from getting a general recognition that the world needs to be respected, because a whole lot of it has been hidden by our history, and it's all there. I don't think I'm the first to see it, and that, you know, my brother's also involved in this somewhat, and and there are other people who've contributed mightily to me being able to see it at all.
What of the sites that you talk about in the book, which one is your favorite and why?
I liked in this book particularly, well, there are resolutions in the end to do with geometry that are very clever. Like when Michelangelo redesigns the St. Peter's Basilica. And then when you when you come to a set of diagrams, enormous diagrams that somebody made of Angkor Wat, and day after day you try to understand them, and then you sort of think, well, what's fantastic, you know, that you can work out something like that. But there's one here in this area. I live here with some mountains to the south, and just to my east is a, sorry, to the west, is a fabulous site, which is in the book, in which a triangle, just like the one in Göbekli Tepe, an equilateral triangle, has the same information in it that Göbekli Tepe appears to have.
Hmm, interesting.
And it suggests that Jupiter and the Sun effectively control the nodal period of the Moon. So it's like a very, very bottom line statement out of all of the, you know, the workings out.
One thing from a very layperson's point of view that I find fascinating, even, you know, beyond the scope of today's conversation, is when you look at all of these ancient sites around the world, you see many times the same kinds of themes cropping up, ostensibly between civilizations that varied in time frame. Geographically, they were very disparate. You would think one would not be able to communicate with the other, but yet the same types of themes show up. What do you, how do you account for that?
Well, here we come to a popular kind of idea that there are people who still understand something. And so at some stage, either because the culture would have done away with them, or because some elite have maintained some knowledge, then, for instance, there's a Buddhist site, which is circular. You know, there's the Pantheon, which is a sphere, really, from the floor up to the top of the dome. All these things have the same characteristic of showing us the Earth relative to the Moon, which has a size difference of 11 to 3. And in my last book about the language of the angels, this became a major theme. And there you... Why are they doing that? Because ostensibly it has it maybe gives a good mood, you know, maybe people feel something, but, you know, the idea of it, it's been kept alive. And indeed, maybe I wouldn't be here without these traditions somehow surviving, despite the fact that the culture wasn't sympathetic to that kind of thing. I mean, at one stage, before the Reformation in Britain, where they did away with the churches, King Henry VIII, they would sometimes cart off all the strange works from the universities that had to do with numbers, done by, they say, curious fellows, you know, people who oughtn't to be messing about with God.
Hmm.
So, you know, if a culture can't understand or accept something, it goes underground, perhaps. And it does seem to have done. It also went into Islam. The Dome of the Rock is another example, a very perfect example of this design.
Well, there's a lot to absorb here, a lot of knowledge from Richard Heath. The new book is Sacred Geometry in Ancient Goddess Cultures, The Divine Science of the Female Priesthood. Richard, where can people find this book and also find more information about all of your work?
Right. I have a website with a little advert on the right-hand side, which shows all the places, but it's distributed by Simon & Schuster. It's published by Inner Traditions, Simon Schuster has a list of places they distribute to. And of course, you know, there are the usual suspects. So, you know, I think there will be no difficulty in obtaining it. And if there is any, you can always go back to Simon & Schuster or Inner Traditions.
Well, I've got to say it should be very easy to find, of course, on Amazon, all the usual places in the States, Barnes & Noble, I'm sure, and in all of those places. So it should be very, very easy to get. Go ahead.
I have a website, by the way. I don't think you've been on it. The name of it is sacred dot number sciences dot org. I have quite a lot of incidental information there on my work, but nothing like what has to be done with a book.
Yes, definitely. This certainly goes in depth, and it's a very substantial book with illustrations and just very nicely done. The book is.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah. Sacred Geometry in Ancient Goddess Cultures, the Divine Science of the Female Priesthood. Richard Heath, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Jim.
And thank you for tuning in. We appreciate it. One thing we want these shows to do is make you think. I think we succeeded in that today. And we hope you'll check out the book. We thank you for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time and keep exploring those mysteries. Bye-bye, everybody.